You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello everyone, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and it is the 19th of July, 2023. As always, I thank my donors and supporters. That means the world to me, and I, of course, am in great need of your support. But also, Sven Longshanks has an even greater need. And we can never, ever forget about him and never forget what the regime will do to its opponents. And speaking of which, I promised you last week I did a lecture on Dugin's sources of understanding the special military operation or Russia's invasion of Ukraine. You know, economically, religiously, and all the different variables that you need to understand to be able to fill out an understanding. And of course, these variables are, they might as well be in Hindi as far as the Anglo-American scholars are concerned. They have no conception of any of this. But I promised at the end of last week's lecture talk that I was going to do something that I keep talking about but haven't done systematically. And that is to explain in detail why I firmly believe that advanced capitalism, meaning the capitalism roughly that we live in today, and advanced socialism, that is to say the Soviet system, not socialism as such, but the Soviet system throughout the, you know, its reign in the 20th century. And in my view, there's really only one way to do that, is that you know, I am extremely well-versed in the ideological justifications and the functioning of both systems. And that's a prerequisite because you need to see what, both in theory and in practice, they have in common. And it was Solzhenitsyn, although I can't remember where, it was one of his later essays. I think it was part of the Under the Rubble collection. The deeper I get into this, the more incredible the similarities. The differences are far less significant. In fact, sometimes I have to work to get to them. Of course, they exist. But normally, you go to college, you talk to any educated person, they'll tell you that the Cold War was a battleground where two opposing ideologies, they say something stupid like, you know, democracy versus Stalinism or something like that. And they're opposing even opposite ideologies. Because they can't see in systematic terms that it comes from the same source and have, and they both maintain the same assumptions. And even, you know, even if they're 50% identical, that would require a complete overhaul of 20th century history, which is never going to happen. And in fact, the reason why that's never going to happen is part of the reason that the two ideologies, social practices, I'm not just talking about theory, but also how they function day to day, are the way they are. And this is hardly a complete list, but I've come up with 46 points of fundamental and practical agreement. And we could get into something else if I don't think this is going to take up the whole hour. If it does, it does. But it's extremely important because it is such a subversive point of view. The first thing I see is their view of history. History, unlike most other schools of thought prior to the Enlightenment. History is linear, and its progress, you could discern what it's progressing towards, and it's progressing towards themselves. This linear, so-called progressive history, and they have the same view of the Middle Ages, by the way, as a sort of interruption there. This is a huge fundamental philosophical approach that they have in common. Second, both ideologies view production and work, especially mass production, machinery production above all, is the critical feature of what they both call a liberated world. Now, needless to say, the third is materialism and secularism, if not total atheism, serve as their foundation. The only thing worth talking about in either system are those things that have an immediate material payoff. Of course, number four, they deny the existence of the soul. Man is simply nerve endings bundled together within a nervous system that has the ability to use logic, not reason, but logic, to reflect on their situation. Number five, both are based on revolution, whether it be the revolution of 1688 or the French Revolution. They're both based on violent revolutions. And that these revolutions aren't just in one place, they need to be imposed everywhere. Number six, there's an official singular ideology that can be questioned only at great expense. And by ideology, I'm talking about the logical organization of their basic assumptions and postulates that promise some version of utopia in the future. And that was Russell Kirk's definition of ideology, and that's what I'm using here. I don't use it that way all the time, but it's significant. Number seven, one of the critical elements is this same, the linear history and scientific progress. More specifically, scientific progress within a Darwinian matrix. Both ideologies are firmly supporters of Darwin. And Darwinism in one form or another has been incorporated into their basic system. Number eight is a little bit more abstract, but both use coded ideological language. When I say coded, I mean that the words that they use in their day-to-day ideological talk, editorial writing or whatever, don't mean what the normal person thinks it means. And in my book on the Soviet Union, I said, the worker or the proletarian isn't just every guy in a factory with a hammer. Many of those guys ended up in the gulag. No, it was their compatriots, their materialistic atheist compatriots in the movement. They could be billionaires. They could be coded ideological language. One of my favorites is the people, which are used in both systems, meaning slightly different things, but they're both completely abstract. That's what I mean by coded ideological language. Number nine, and we know this, unfortunately, at a very painful level, both need, as an imperative, the destruction of all dissent, especially at fundamental levels. I mean, in the Soviet Union, if you wanted dissent from something, you had to put it in Leninist language. Same thing here. If you want to disagree with the regime, you have to put it in liberal language. Number 10, they're kept in power by enormous bureaucracies. And this is just at the state level, at the government level. The U.S. has an additional private sector bureaucracy, which is just as big and just as inefficient. Number 11, both ideologies have a pathological loathing for farmers, peasantry, and agriculture. Both ideologies systematically destroyed the small farm and replaced it with a factory. That's a huge area that they have in common, and it comes from both being based on the Enlightenment. Remember, Marx viewed himself in the same way the capitalists do, as the end of history, in the sense that he is, socialism is, the fulfillment of the Enlightenment promises. And in that vein, number 12, both both have very strong and pronounced arcane and occult foundations. That also is a matter of language. 13, both divide the world in two parts, the liberated part and the so-called authoritarian, or even the backward part. Both the Soviets and the U.S. do this. They're either within the Anglo-American alliance or they're authoritarian rogue states. Rogue from what? Rogue from this very alliance. Soviets, the same thing. They had their compatriots in socialist countries, and then everyone else. 14 is that they both have an ontological desire to make the entire planet one single machine. And that goes especially with mechanized farming used in both the USSR and the USA. The USA is far more advanced, but the ideological concern is identical. 15, they both had a total faith, total unquestioned faith in the rule of technology as the end and purpose of scientific progress. 16, I think I've already mentioned this, the factory system, mass production, is critical for both approaches to the world. They both had factories. Their organization, at least from the central areas, may have been different, but they functioned in basically the same way. If you were a factory worker in Leningrad or a factory worker in Houston, you were pretty much living the same kind of a life. And given all that, number 17, both are solely and exclusively urban in their orientation. Unlike, you know, many nationalists that are agrarian in their orientation. These movements take root in the cities. They take root in some of the most alienated people. People who didn't have a place before. 18. Economics and Darwinian science. And, you know, going back and forth as equal mother systems from which everything derives. Given the rule of quantity, economics is essentially the science of production. And they work together, and everything else derives directly from that. 19, and we've spoken about that on this show many times, they see their approach to the world as universal. There is really no deviation from the linear history. Their categories, you know, production, technology, labor, this development applies to all peoples at all times. They may be different on what stage they're in, but the progression is identical. 20, and this may be a little bit specific, but both Enlightenment capitalism, now in its advanced stage, and Leninism and socialism in general rejects the concept of a human nature. And that's easy to understand. If human nature is this fixed essence, which of course they don't believe in, fixed, and both sides don't believe, then humanity can't be infinitely malleable. Given how both advanced capitalism and advanced Leninism function, having a firm human nature would be a huge roadblock. So it's denied by their scientific elites. 21. Both promise a utopian future of peace and plenty only after a period of present sacrifice. That, again, this is another variation of progress, but using the same kind of terminology. I mean, capitalism even promises life after death with their crazy cryogenics, which makes no sense to me, and it's not what you think it is in terms of its ideological formulation. The conquest of nature, tikkun olam, absolutely identical in both cases. The language is exactly the same. 22, and this has to do, again, with language. They define freedom, that specific term, only with respect to themselves. In other words, you have to accept their basic vocabulary. And then once you do, freedom makes sense. Otherwise, it isn't anything. Someone under a Leninist system is free because he's under a Leninist system. If you're part of the Anglo-American environment, you are also free as a legal individual, as laughable as that actually is in practice. So terms like freedom, liberation, you have to accept their basic definitions before you could even use the term. However, it's used in day-to-day life in the abstract sense that the ordinary person, how they consider it. I mentioned already 23, the rule of quantity and the negation of quality. People who read Gnon and Evol are well aware of what I'm talking about. To be real, it has to be numbered. It has to be well-ordered. It has to be easily referenced. 24, when they talk about well-being, when they talk about the few times they actually talk about happiness, it's always in quantitative terms. It's measured in money, production, and technology. And don't think that capitalism wasn't talking about the release from alienation. How work is going to change. There's going to be more freedom loving in the future. That's central to the Great Reset. 25. Anti-racism and anti-nationalism are absolute core ideas, whether it be in foreign or domestic policy. Yeah, that doesn't even have to be argued. This is why in 1945, the U.S., British Empire on the one hand and the Soviet Union on the other agreed to divide up the entire world between them. So it was just two variations of the left. And what wasn't represented, of course, is nationalism, national socialism, whatever. What they did to South Africa is absolutely criminal. 26. Again, I've hinted at this too. The contempt for the Middle Ages as this interruption, regression in the path to utopia. And they also glorify the Renaissance. And this has something to do with their use of occult and arcane doctrines, which is what the Renaissance really was. And because it was a negation of the Middle Ages, it must be a good thing since it put all of this stuff on the proper footing. 27. The dishonest use of terms. And this is similar to something I've already said. The workers, the people, rights, trials, freedoms, even constitutions. You know, both constitutions, the various ones they had in the Soviet Union, the American one, their words printed on a piece of paper, and they have no more importance than that. Just like in the Soviet Union, they may use the verbiage, but in terms of its content, that's long gone. 28. Both systems try to cleanse their societies from their own past. And the U.S. simply is better at it than the USSR. The USSR was more thoroughgoing and systematic. The American version is more psychological, but they also use violent force whenever they can. And things like the Red Guards are what Antifa is here. The state can't get its hands dirty in these things, so they'll pretend that this is just a private, popular organization that's going to do their will. And that's all those groups are. The Red Guards and Antifa are the same thing. So cleansing their societies of who they are, their own history, mocking and hating their own history, was essential to both systems. 29, and many of you may wonder why it's taken me so long to get here, but both ideologies fervently supported Zionism, and more importantly, both systems have a Jewish core. The Jewish mentality is present in both systems, and so it probably shouldn't surprise you that they're very similar. 30, both employ draconian hate speech laws, and they connect employment or basic social functioning to your ideological conformity. As you know, I spoke about the Nazarov case 2 weeks ago in the Daily Nationalist. And that the Russian so-called hate speech laws don't exist. They're not for, and they're not employed in the same way that it's done in the West. But things like, you know, any racial talk, especially when it comes to white people, and of course the Holocaust, these are illegal. And as we all know, you go to jail for this. Given the nature of surveillance and the web, it's now tough to get a job if you've been flagged for this kind of behavior. 31, and I've said this 100 times, They both share a devotion to nominalism and some version of positivism. The Soviet psychiatric establishment spoke of Pavlov, who was essentially the positivist of old Russia. 32, and this should ring very familiar, both systems politicize things that shouldn't be politicized. They take something like medicine or psychology, and they shoehorn the ideological verbiage into it. And I predicted the next DSM comes out for psychology, there's going to be a disorder that can apply to people like us, like opposition, antisocial, or redefinition of those terms. There already is oppositional, defiant, and antisocial. But either they'll come up with a new category, or they'll redefine a present one. In terms of more recent history, both systems see Adolf Hitler as the greatest evil that ever existed. And therefore, World War II was the most lofty goal, and mass death and slaughter to close down the camps was a useful and praiseworthy sacrifice. And of course, neither system spoke of Hitler without talking about the Jews instantaneously, as if that's the only thing he cared about. It was one of a million issues that he had to tackle. 35. Both accept at least the legal equality of the sexes, feminism and the sexual revolution are built in to these systems. Now, it's true, the Soviets tried to impose it immediately after, in the early 20s, and because it was imposed so rapidly, it failed. In the U.S., after World War II, it took a while, actually, before World War II, in terms of abortion, liberalized divorce laws, whatever it is, feminism, it was gradually imposed, everything from the Supreme Court to entertainment media and whatever. And that's one of the reasons that as far as social acceptance, it was successful in the West, but not in the Soviet Union. Nevertheless, that was that was the key understanding. 36, I've hinted at this already too. The use of mental illness and the treatment of mental illness as a way to control dissent. People like me and you are assumed to be mentally ill in some capacity or another. Now, I've done a whole lecture on Soviet punitive psychiatry and psychology, so I don't have to get too deeply into this. But terming or labeling people as mentally ill as a way to shut them up is important to both systems. 37, no surprise. Both systems had a tight control over entertainment and the arts. Even, in the American case, even at the loss of billions of dollars. I talked about the movie Cry of Freedom or Sound of Freedom. That is blowing away, and at least it was last weekend, the Raiders of the Lost Ark sequel. And I want to take a minute to mention this, and it's irritating the hell out of me. The use of the word woke obviously is relevant here, is really incorrect. This is the same leftist movement that's been operating in America since the radical Reconstruction era, and certainly since the late 60s. You have a lot of ordinary people thinking that this woke revolution is something completely different, that it just showed up out of nowhere. Go to any comedy, especially older comedy YouTube video, and see what people are saying. There's always somebody who will say, well, you couldn't do that today. And they usually have no conception of why not. It's a purely ideological imposition. Woke makes it seem like, first of all, it's their propaganda, and which itself is a problem. And also, it's just a new name for the exact same thing. The media manipulation of names and labels is extremely important. Okay, number 38. both have a huge system of prisons. We all know that Western Europe especially has hundreds if not thousands of purely political prisoners. Sven Longshanks is just one. Go look up the nationalist parties in Western Europe and see how many of their people are in prison. Huge prison systems. I think the American prison system isn't as integrated into the economy as the Gulag was. I have no difficulty with having prisoners work for almost nothing, so long as they're actually violent prisoners. I don't think nonviolent people should be in prison at all. That doesn't make any sense. But anyway, they were both a requirement for the system, and it goes along with these large bureaucracies that they both created. At its most fundamental, number 39, both systems are totalitarian. And I use that word very carefully. Totalitarianism has the word total in it. That means there is no aspect of social or even individual life that is not subject, or at least potentially subject, to regulation. Just following, you know, the nature of American lawsuits, there is nothing that you can't get sued from or about or over. Soviet Union was totalitarian in simply the way it functioned. No one would say that about the U.S. except for people who have been victims of it. There is nothing you can do, whether it be workplace or living in a city or an apartment building, that can't cause you to get into serious trouble. They are both totalitarian systems, and both systematically so. It's not a patchwork in the U.S. No, they're both systems. 40, and this is similar to 38, but it is distinct. Both systems employed an enormous police force. And in a police force both at local and central levels. Far large. I mean, there was no such thing in the Middle Ages and in the Renaissance, even early modernity. You know, police forces and prisons were the creation of the Enlightenment. 41, it is imperative for both systems to both, you know, sanitize and rewrite its own history. It has something to do with cleansing both systems of their past, their pre-revolutionary past. Rewriting their own history and have this be official and so-called mainstream, and dissent is simply not only is not permitted. The enforcement mechanisms may differ, but it doesn't matter. You know, oppression is oppression. I don't care who does it. But it could destroy a career. 42, and this hardly needs an explanation, but both systems absolutely demonize and dehumanize their enemies. They both use propaganda and call it news. They had such a kept journalistic class that, you know, I never thought journalism was a proper field of study at all. You know, I've always complained that these people, they're covering sometimes very complex things, whether it be, you know, COVID or Indian politics or Bangladeshi politics, and none of them are educated in this field. They're educated in how to tell a story. That's what journalism is, not to be knowledgeable. It simply doesn't make any sense. These people could be, you know, asked to write an article on anything, and they have to pretend they know something about it. Using propaganda and ideological sloganeering and calling it news, both systems are identical in that respect. And the dehumanization of their enemies. I'm talking about words like redneck and white trash, and that people like us should simply be destroyed. And that makes sense, since most people are completely innocent about what we're doing. I guarantee you, in any free election, people like me are going to do better than these than regime members. That's why it can't be permitted. 43, the absolute rejection of self-discipline and asceticism. Now, of course, the Soviets just redefined self-discipline to, you know, working in their factories. But in the revolutionary era, you know, that's their wild side, the Dionysian side, has to be released. There's no concept of asceticism. Desire should be increased, added one to another. And of course, in the later Soviet Union as well as today in the U.S., the encouragement of mass consumption. And of course, the concomitant concept of work. Notice I didn't say labor. I said work. 44, both created highly militarized, very ideological empires. 45, and this kind of sums up the whole thing. They both systems see themselves as the end and purpose of history and the true heir to the Enlightenment. So I finish kind of where I started. And as far as, I guess technically these are 46, both systems almost glorify warfare, so long as it's on their terms. And warfare has a lot to do with imposing their revolutionary ideology around the world. So, that, and again, I don't want to claim that this is a complete list, because it isn't. There's a lot of overlap here, but that doesn't mean that all of these are distinct one from another. Rewriting history is one thing. That's only a small part of cleansing their respective societies of their past, you know, whether it be rulers or religions or whatever. Now, these are 45 or 46 substantial and fundamental points of blatant and obvious parallel. And the conclusion is an obvious one. The conclusion is they are sister ideologies that have far more in common than they do. The differences are relatively trivial. Like, for example, there was no such thing as a private sector bureaucracy in the Soviet Union, but there obviously is in the U.S. or wherever. So now that I have that out of the way, I want to go somewhere else. And this is relevant. In fact, this leads us to, as I mentioned, the Jewish idea at its core. And many of you know that since I started here, especially over the last 6-7 years, I've stressed the concept of New Kazadia. So many of our people, especially when I was at the Barnes Review, Zionism is a huge issue. You know, on the one hand, every people should be able to have a state society. If they're self-conscious enough to want as a nation. On the other hand, Israel is constituted like no other state. One of the reasons that Rabbi David Weiss and so many others reject Zionism is that it requires Jews to put themselves in positions where they're eventually going to be hated. They have to control foreign policy and economic policy and have a hand in the taxpayers' pockets at all times in order to keep this non-viable state functioning. New Kazaria is a different story, and in fact, it can be called a third Kazaria, and I may maybe get to that in a minute. And I've had several lectures on this topic in the past, but I'm in the midst of, you know, everything I do is like 50 pages long, putting together a more cohesive and comprehensive idea of what New Kazaria is. Most of you, if not all of you, know what Kazaria was. In the middle period, I should say, you know, the early Middle Ages, Kazaria was a racially mixed empire on the Black and Caspian Seas that was Judaic, run by converts, at least taking into itself the ruling class and those with any kind of money or influence. It was smashed by the monarch Svyatoslav of Kiev at the end of the 10th century. Because it was a largely hidden Jewish empire, long before there was any conception of Zionism, politically speaking, it remains, at least to the Ashkenazi, the Talmudic Jews, another ideal, especially if the ideal of Israel fails. Jews are well aware that Israel is small, and despite their chemical and nuclear weapons, their military luck may run out at any time. Now, when I use the word Jew, I'm only speaking of the Talmud. If a Jew doesn't follow the Talmud, I'm not calling them a Jew. And actually, this was the medieval point of view in both East and West, and the 109, whatever it is, 112 expulsions of the Jews from cities or countries or principalities. It only referred to those in the rabbinic and Talmudic system. If you were Karaite or Samaritan or, you know, any of these other groups, you were not affected and you weren't considered a Jew. So I want to be very careful there as well. But that Talmudic, the so-called Ashkenazim, are descended physically from the semi-Turkic tribes that came together to form Khazaria. Now, there are plenty, especially in Russia, that hold the Soviet Union was the second Khazaria. And up until very recently, the Jewish domination of all of Ukraine, especially in Odessa, would be the third, especially if things go south in Israel. And I've covered some of this before, but not really in any great detail, at least not that I could remember. Who knows? But as always, I go back to the prophets. And I'm not the first one to notice this, but the great prophet Ezekiel predicted that the temple, the so-called, you know, the main shrine, the central, both ethnic and religious institution, the Temple of Solomon and all that that implies, that would be destroyed. Nebuchadnezzar left it in ruins. Ezekiel, when he was resting one day, he had a vision. And the vision was, it goes like this. And the word of the Lord came to me, son of man, turn your face to Gog in the land of Magog, the prince of Rosh, Mesech, and Tubal. Prophecy against him and say, here I am confronting you, Gog, prince of Rosh, Mesech, and Tubal. One of the many reasons that the prophets aren't read, because people would have to start digging into what this is. I've said this many times before, but starting at least during the Crimean War, the Anglo-American Christian establishment began claiming that the great Antichrist war is going to be against Russia. That Rosh was somehow a synonym for Rus, because at least in our language, it vaguely sounds alike, which is probably the worst argument you could ever, you know, amateur historians fall for that all the time, because today in 2023, two words sound alike, one from the ancient world, one from this world. They're related. Now, the term Gog is simply a prince. And by these names, both Talmudists and the Protestants, especially in the U.S., deliberately so, but mistakenly understand Russia. Specifically, beyond Russia, also Moscow, and this is less and less supported, but Tobolsk, that's supposed to be Tubal. The last one has a very thin strand behind it, but that Mesek is supposed to be Moscow and Russia. Now, Gog and Magog will be organized by Lucifer, therefore Russia must become his instrument. Not to mention be the main enemy of Israel, U.S., Europe, and evil that needs to be destroyed. I mentioned that before. And that has something to do, and don't underestimate, the power of that ideology in the current war. There's no doubt, especially given the language of the higher officials, military and civilian government in Russia, that smashing the growth of this new Khazaria had something to do with the invasion last year. And that has a lot to do, too, with the aggressive, obsessive, irrational hatred of Russia by the ruling class. And the justification is already being used. Protestant fundamentalists are one of the most perverse, destructive, and irrational sects that have ever existed. They are, like it or not, deep within the American foreign policy establishment, or at least are used by those who, you know, hate Russia and those who want to support Israel. You have American preachers all over the place in their ignorance talking about Russia as Gog and Magog, and they do have an influence on society. If you exploit this, you can continuously escalate, especially Protestant anti-Russian attitudes. And it does affect the top leadership in the USA. The Russian Antichrist was a term coined during the Crimean War. In the British press, Tsar Nicholas I was called Tsar Gog. And this happened again, you know, under Ronald Reagan, in referring to the USSR as the evil empire in that famous speech. It wasn't anti-Soviet. It was anti-Russian. And there is an argument that it was Hal Lindsey that encouraged him to make these statements. What used to be anti-Soviet, especially in the neocons, has been revealed to be anti-Russia. In fact, the Soviets were never a problem, although Reagan may have disagreed. But nationalism, especially Russian nationalism, is a totally different story. And all this harkens back to these similarities that both system has. The war, I mean, the war on Russia, the Soviet Union was, Russia was a constituent element, and Stalin did everything he could to cleanse Russians from positions there. That's hard to do in Russia, but I've actually gone over this before. In fact, the Lindsey was at the White House to lecture on Russian Gog Magog. He lectured on Reagan's orders to the Pentagon brass. Jerry Falwell was also a close advisor to the U.S. government, even to the point of being involved in meetings within the White House. George W. Bush made it clear that his foreign policy is based on these concepts. Now, it wasn't the case with Obama, but the only difference is the same neocons just dropped the theological element and added the fact that Russia is aggressive and reactionary. But I believe, and so do many others, especially abroad, that the Gog-Magog connection with Russia is a deliberate deception, deliberately falsified, because it is one other route to manipulate the population who has absolutely nothing to gain in these wars. Now, you have Latin sources in the Middle Ages, especially. See it in places like Aquitaine, although Greek was very important there too. They preserved the name of Russia correctly. Rosh in Hebrew means head. So the Prince Rosh means the Prince of Princes, the Chief Prince. And you see this in the Vulgate, translates it as the head of princes. You see it in the Syriac, New Testament as ruler and great leader. And even in Arabic, it's interpreted as the Prince of Princes. And Rosh at no time ever referred to an ethnic group. Now, of course, Moscow, other cities in Russia didn't exist during Ezekiel's era, only coming into existence as a global force at least 1,500 years later. Meshek is not Moscow. Gog is the chief prince, the leader of the peoples of Meshek and Tubal in the land of Magog. And by prior to the 19th century, that location is in the northern part of the Caucasus near the Caspian Sea, that is to say, the territory of Khazaria. Now, there have been a few people, identity people and so many others, who have teased all of this out. Meshek is the sixth son of Japhet. So, in the Old Testament, Japhet is the third son of Noah, and one of the founders, along with Ham and Shem, of the different human races. And even in Russian translation, tribe of Japhet means the tribe of white people. There was a group of people who we might term the Mosks. And Meshek is called the ancestor of the Mosk, people who lived between the Black and Caspian Seas, also correlating with Khazaria. it's reasonable to think that the mosques were ancestors of the Khazars in one form or another. In Psalm 119, I believe it's verse 5, the word Mesek is used as a synonym or basic general name for aliens. Alexander Vasilev, and I think I have covered this before a long time ago, in his book, The Goths in the Crimea, he quotes from St. Albo of Tbilisi, Georgia. And because they were very close to it, he said that, quote, the Khazars were wild sons of Magog, end quote, who had no religion, although they recognized the existence of a single god. Elkin Adler, in his book Jewish Travelers, he refers to the notes of Rabbi Pitakia, and the notes that he made on his travels concerning Bulan's conversion. And the Rabbi Pitakia, in particular, note that the Kaganet originated from the ancient mosques. Remember, Kagan is the heads of Khazari, and you see Kaganovich as a Jewish name today. Tubal is another one. It's less well developed, but it refers to the tribes that migrated most likely the northern coast of the Black Sea. And in Russia, it's common to say that they are expressed in the Russian chronicles as Tiberians, also from the Khazar region. An ancient Jewish historian, Joseph, who died 500 years before the foundation of Khazaria, writes about Tubal as a brother of Mesek and gives him a characteristic that totally coincides, so to speak, with the Khazar. And one of his quotes is, quote, Tubal surpassed all the nations in strength and was very skilled for their violent military exploits, end quote. But Gog and Magog, because you'll hear this in any Protestant meeting house, the truth is that the eschatological concept is found in the apocalypse. These are warlike people. They're opponents of the people of God. They will show themselves in the last times and unleash a completely destructive and universal war. Even in Islam, you have Yajuj and Majuj. I doubt I'm pronouncing that right, but I can't do the gutturals like so many people can. But in the Quran, the same description exists. Gog and Magog were termed warlike and without any moral scruples, in warfare or otherwise. Now, we all know Arthur Koestler. I don't have to get into him in any depth, but one of the interesting aspects of Koestler is the sources that he has uncovered. The Arab Chronicles had zero sympathy for the Khazars. You can't find any group of people who had any sympathy with the Khazars who lived either around them or at the same time. And it shouldn't surprise you that Georgian and Armenian authors, far closer to the action than most, are exactly the same. And the chroniclers there say their countries were constantly devastated by Khazar slave raids. Now, the Georgian chronicles, because they bordered each other, they define Khazaria as the host of Gog and Magog. And and this is how they describe them. They are wild people with terrible, evil faces and manners of wild animals that feed on blood. Heinrich von Neustadt, who died in the High Middle Ages, 1300, also referred to by Koestler, talks about the Khazars as the terrifying, animalistic people of Gog and Magog. And I've been through this before, but there's nothing wrong with going through it again. And in those languages, also in Russia, you have all of these sources, which a lot of people don't know exist. B.N. Zelhoder, in his Caspian and Eastern Europe, a book in Russian, and he says, one of the confirmations of the correctness of this understanding, that is to say, Khazar understanding, is the fact that outside of the Arab-Persian writing in the middle of the same 9th century, we find the likening of Gog and Magog to the Huns and Khazars in the writings of the monk Drutmar from Aquitaine, and his commentaries in the Gospel of Matthew. The Khazars are also called Huns by Moses Kagankevatsi, a 10th century Georgian author. But even Josephus, defined Magog as the territory located along the northern coast of the Black Sea. The descendants of Japheth settled north of the Caucasus. Again, same place. And even the Jewish Encyclopedia. Magog was located within the Caucasian mountain ridge close to the Caspian Sea. Khazar territory. Rabbi Histai Sharpit, writing in 9th century Spain, wrote to the Khazar Khan, calling him the Prince of Rosh, Meshech, and Tubal. But Gog and Magog are essential. Essentially, it's one entity. Because they will appear at the end times, innumerable. And not necessarily just them, but also their clients. From the four corners of the earth, they'll begin to exterminate, at last, the Orthodox people, surrounding the famous phrase, the camp of the saints and the beloved city. But they will be struck by fire from heaven at the most decisive moment in the battle, in the 20th chapter of Revelation. Gog appears as a symbolic name, a general descriptor, represents the leading element of the forces that oppose God. Even Ezekiel, you know, he says, get ready, equip yourself, prepare yourself. You and all your hordes gather to you and be their leader. Gog refers to the name of the leadership and Magog, the name of the people as a whole. So in Ezekiel, Magog is the land. But in the New Testament, of course, it refers to the people who inhabited that land. And there doesn't seem to be any division between Meshech and Tubal, because they're presented as one nation, united at least by a geographic territory. At the same time, the most direct associations arise with Khazaria, that is, the land of Magog. And the Khazars, the people of Magog, absorbed the tribes of Meshech and Tubal. Gog, of course, the chief prince, ruler of the land and the peoples of Magog, that is, Khazaria. The great church father, Blessed Theodoret, he writes this, let me quote him directly here. I'm quoting this from the Russian, so it might be a little choppy. Before the coming of Christ, that is to say, the second coming, the enemy of man and the adversary of God, the demon, thief of God's name, clothed in human nature, will appear in the world. And of course, Khazaria is at the center. Lev Gumilev, the great modern historian, I should say ancient historian. Very few people have written on the Khazars like Gumilev has. And they're called the evil genius of ancient Russia. And that many of the Jewish Khazars migrated to Europe and became what we know as the Ashkenazim. And I can go through just the hundreds of sources that get very, very boring, all saying the same thing. And the first mention, and V. Snyder claims that the process of this migration might be predicted in the prophet Jeremiah. So there the Jews who left with the Scythians received the name Ashkenazi. In the place of their settlement is indicated as the north of Oukimen, again, in the present North Caucasus. So many Jews, Polak, so many others, I forget his first name, Polak. The theory is based on the idea that the migration of the Khazar Jews to the west after the collapse of the Khazar Khanate has created what we call Jews today. The books such as The History of Antisemitism, 5,000 Years of Jewish History, Halter's The Khazar Empire, came out in 2005, and all the rest. And it really doesn't matter where you find them. Wherever the Khazars settled, we know what happens. Using their cohesiveness, they occupy the most important political and financial offices possible. Controlling the royal treasuries, the salt monopoly in Central Europe, coining of money, tax collection, and of course, usury. And since they had a huge network, no one could really afford to irritate them except, of course, the common population. They end up using usury in control of the wealth, a huge portion of the wealth of the countries to which they have migrated. Even Cecilia Roth, right in the Encyclopedia Britannica, 1973, right in her article, Jews, notes that during the Middle Ages in Western Europe, and I assume she means the High Middle Ages, all trade in Western Europe was, quote, predominantly in Jewish hands, not excluding the slave trade, and the terms Jew and trader were used as two interchangeable concepts, end quote. You know, we spoke in the Zadov case that one of the reasons that there was no way he was going to be indicted, as Sven Longshanks was, is that when it comes to his most controversial claims, he doesn't just use any source, he strictly uses Jewish sources. Which, in the letter, if you heard a couple weeks ago, where they said they're not going to prosecute him, that was part of the reason. In other words, truth really does matter. And of course, their language is not Hebrew, it's Yiddish. The Khazars are a Turkic people, essentially. And so a mixture of that language, German, and the Slavic languages, there's a smattering of Hebrew, that ultimately what, and it's classified as a synthetic language. Essentially what Yiddish is. But in Middle Ages, East and West, Gog and Magog were depicted when they're personified as having dog heads, what Gumilev calls a chimera. And he coined that term to refer to any political phenomenon that is based on chaos. Sometimes I call, so-called American culture an anti-culture, because it doesn't have any of the traits of culture. Culture and tradition are pretty much two sides of the same coin. Well, Gumilev uses the word anti-system, referring to the chimera of Khazaria. And he describes it as representing a social formation of a purely negative type. In other words, a population thrown together who has nothing in common with one another, an artificial formation. You make a distinction between a collective and a community. A community is bonded by blood, tradition, religion. They belong together. They grew up, so to speak, together as extended family. Now, a collective is just people randomly thrown in one place. So most of the cities in America are collectives. They have no community. And they certainly don't share ethnic roots. And the people who bring that about and profit from that system preserve and reproduce its chaotic existence over time. And the final manifestation, Adam Kadmon, Antichrist, speaking generally. The invisible Khazaria, or the third Khazaria, is the archetype of the global anti-state. The global anti-state of Antichrist itself. Khazaria, in all three of its manifestations, the ancient world, in the Soviet Union, and this one, controlled by the capitalist powers, not controlled by them, but diplomatically and militarily defended by them, is connected with the colonization of southern Ukraine. And all three were implemented as extraterritorial, in other words, international, supranational projects aimed at fighting traditional statehood, whether royal or national. And of course, up until to this day, they see Russia as the restrainer, even more obvious to them, the Tsar of Russia, as the main obstacle to its political materialization. So the invisible Khazaria, we talked quite a bit about the blatant similarities between Leninism and advanced capitalism, and we have them both at different periods of time working together to bring this about. Gumilev sees ancient Khazaria as both at the time and its newer so-called spiritual formulation. It's a government of a sort that unites idolaters with an economy that's united, or at least not fragmented, in international networks who, through the control of money and debt, subjugate and destroy other nations. They don't produce because usury and production are two different things. Invisible Khazaria now, it's a networked entity, rather than any kind of centralized one. And so many Russian writers, and Azarov himself, they oppose the natural hierarchy of the legitimate state principle and are constantly at war against it. I've referred to the regime with a capital R as this network of power centers, you know, academic, journalistic, scientific, whatever. But the regime is an anti-system. I mean, it works systematically. But the regime is a system in the same sense that America has a culture. It's a system that functions through networks. It's a revolutionary solvent to whoever they need to destroy. Yeah, Svatoslav the First of Kiev destroyed the visible Khazarian a very long time ago. But the invisible version, like its medieval version, does have its own armed forces, the core of which is essentially mercenaries and today private military companies. They use the armies of vassal peoples, and this is how they are physically fighting for their own materialization, what we used to call the New World Order, now the Great Reset, the new man of the French revolutionaries and the Soviet revolutionaries. Svatoslav destroyed the visible Khazarian between 963 and 965, and it helped define Russian identity, at least in a negative way, as the ethnic group that's going to oppose Khazarian. It was the origin of the concept of the restrainer against the rulers of darkness, Russia and the Tsar as the Khaton, the restraining force. Rulers of darkness, as they say, seizing power in both the visible and now the invisible Khazarian. Svatoslav defeated the visible and political Khazarian, and don't forget who his son was, Saint Vladimir, who laid out the blueprint of the Orthodox faith in Russia. And a short time after, St. Vladimir challenged the invisible, Antichrist Khazarian. No nation other than Russia is hated by this entity with the white-hot hatred that they hate Russia. The concept of hierarchical sacred statehood led by the Russian monarch is not just an obstacle to their global project, but it's a political stronghold of everything that Khazarian hates, however imperfect it may be. So the Khazar anti-system, in order to destroy this, did everything it could to wage war on undermining Orthodoxy. The Russians had no idea what was in store for them after 1918. Periods of revenge, endless tragedies, war, and suffering. And of course, explicitly, the murder of Tsar Nicholas II was very much like this. You could assume that Gog will achieve influence over a huge number of subjects, but largely through economic or political or even now informational and psychological influences on them. It's not woke, it's just the left. The media gave it this term, as I said a while ago. The regime gives this movement that term as if it's something new, rather than just them. As E. Michael Jones says, introducing the spirit of the left into the average person's default settings of a universal mentality. Of course, Gumilev says anti-systems create anti-system ideologies, and that's what the left is in general. Anyway, I'm running a little long. I hope you could see the connection between New Khazaria, or the invisible Khazaria, and the identity of Leninism and capitalism. Because they both serve it, and they both, in different ways, allowed it to thrive. And they're both united by a single ideology. And that is they deny the real world. Include, I'm not just talking about nominalism. But they deny the real world and its complexity and its legitimate diversity in the name of purely abstract and rhetorical goals. Goals that they have no intention of promoting once in power. If you've read my book on the Soviet Union, I make a big deal about this. They had no intention of making good on their promises. There's another law other than the first Johnson's law, which you all know what that is. There is a second one. I don't know how original it is. But the idea of an ideology that on paper or in rhetoric is beautiful and it all hangs together and it's all logical. And oh my God, wouldn't the world be a great place if we just did this? I'm not even talking about socialism as such, but ideologies tend to be like this. The minute someone takes power and starts imposing, no matter what their intentions are. They could have the purest of intentions when they start. Sorry, I got cut off there. I'm going to bring this to a close. Thank everyone of you for listening. I will talk to you next time. Bye-bye.